Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope, and I'm your host, Rory Hearn. And I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Stephen Kinsler today, Head of Department of Economics in the University of Limerick, and also he is Chief Writer at the Currency, Chief Economics Writer, should I say, for the Currency News, and he was also a columnist with the Sunday Business Post. He's written for The Guardian, The New York Times, numerous books on economics and the Irish economy, and he's twice won Economic Commentator of the Year. Stephen, thanks a million for joining me on Reboot Republic today.
My pleasure, Rory. Congrats on the columns that have been coming out in the last few weeks, and they're really high quality, stimulating public debate, and that's exactly what academics like yourself should do.
I appreciate that, Stephen. It is hard work. And it's challenging, but it is, as you say, really, really important, particularly given where we're at. And I suppose just what we want to talk about today is that issue of housing, understanding our housing system, you know, what role economics can play in helping us understand it and pointing ways to solve what has become, in many ways, a catastrophic housing crisis affecting our society, affecting our future. And really damaging people's lives in this country. And just before we go into it, though, a reminder to our listeners, and thank you to those who are patrons. We are an independent podcast. We're completely reliant on our listeners to keep us going. Tony Groves of Tortoise Shack Media produces the podcast. If you can support us, go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Help us to avoid having to put silly ads in these podcasts. Or I don't know, making me talk about toothpaste or something like that, even though I know some of you would like me to do that. But listen, go over if you can support us. And also just thanks to Kino Callahan from the Social Democrats, who raised the story of Kira, who we spoke to on this podcast last week, who is a disabled person, is homeless, is living in her car, and she told us her story and he raised it in the Dáil, and hopefully there will be progress on that. So thanks to Keen for that. Stephen, I suppose straight off, the housing crisis, and we're seeing increasingly within the debate around potential solutions, there are a number of ones that I have put forward and others as well. For example, you know, a public enterprise that would be a public home building company, you know, using, for example, the land that NAMA has to build affordable homes. Taking up the excellent report that Professor Kieran McQuinn did in the ESRI in terms of increasing borrowing for the state to build. And essentially, in many ways, I kind of boil it down to a case that the state should be playing a much, much greater role in guaranteeing and delivering housing for a range of incomes, social housing, cost rental, affordable purchase. And that is not about replacing the private sector, but it is about absolutely playing a much, much greater role than it is currently playing. And that really, that is a direction we should go in and would really help solve the crisis. What's your view on that?
Well, I guess the first thing is you're one of very few people writing for the public from a position of expertise, coming up with constructive potential proposals. And that's one of them. And that's why I was so chuffed to read it, because if you look at where the state, if you just think about the state as something that injects money, right? Yeah. Where is the state in the housing system? It's everywhere, right? Yeah. You have the state as the originator of the lands for many projects. The Oscar Traynor site's a perfect example, but there are loads of them. You have the state as the allocator of funds to private companies to tender for the funds to build public and social housing, but also you have the state acting as the, if you like, the anchor tenant for a lot of places, either by purchasing social housing or by renting housing from the private sector. You have the state then paying for the upkeep of lots of these lands. You have the state paying for the servicing of some of the lands. It is. The state is everywhere. It's in the supply end of things. It's in the demand end of things. It's in the maintenance end of things. And so your proposal essentially is to create a kind of an ESB for home building,
Yeah.
Right. So to take, and I would imagine that the way that that would actually work is you take a really big one. There's a couple of big construction companies down I'm familiar with here in Limerick, but if you take one of them, you know, they have, you know, 1,000 builders working for them. Right. And they're a private company. They're very good at what they do. They've got, you know, project managers and engineers and all this kind of expertise. And, you know, they're a private company and the state could simply buy them. So you could just nationalize those fellas and say, now, Bob, your job is to do this on behalf of the state. Right? You make the builders who are currently working on contracts, public sector workers, and rock on from there. Right. And you essentially, you pay the owners a bit of money, whatever, but the sums involved here are in the tens of billions. So that's not that's nothing more than a rounding error. And what you do then is you build up, you increase from there. That is, by the way, how the ESB started. There were loads of private providers all over the place and providing electricity in Dublin and other places. They never got out to the rural areas. Why? Because the market wouldn't go there. And so it's a really interesting idea. What it does effectively is it produces an in-house delivery mechanism for the state. Now, you might argue that what that would do is crowd out private sector investment, involvement, or profit. If you look at the actual character on the ground of what is being produced for profit at the minute, it's not enough. And that's why you have stories like the one you told in the previous podcast. And it's why a large part of it is why this exists. The reality is the market can't square the equation of very high construction costs with a need to hold a profit margin, with a need to deal with the uncertainty and risk around any development, with the need to sell for an affordable price. So it just can't, the market can't square that at the moment. So you could have the state step in and actually provide both a price floor, simply saying we as the state agree to lose money on all of these properties, right? Which is what they will do in any case. I mean, we lose money in the sense that the state pays for both the production and the maintenance of these facilities anyway, through HAP and other means. So you can say, look, we're doing that. And we're also going to put a floor on workers' wages, because if a certain cadre of builder above a certain level of expertise and experience and education gets to become, if you like, a public servant builder, it would be a very interesting, almost, I wouldn't call it a monopoly, but it would be a very interesting state development company. It would have three impacts. I don't believe it would cause a crowding out of investment. That argument is an argument that comes from I'm hesitant to brand any branch of academic literature discredited, apart from the Laffer curve, which is literally discredited. Nobody believes that stuff anymore. But in economics, the idea of crowding out as a theory has been widely, it's not discredited, but it's far less viewed as important than it was. It's a textbook model, but really, when you look at the data, it's not there. So I don't believe the crowding out argument. I think what you would find is you would find the state building homes and the private sector building everything else, commercial, whatever. And you would also see a situation where the price of housing stabilized around a certain period, a certain amount. So that'd be interesting. The other aspect, which I think is fascinating, is by creating a stable career path. And I believe you spoke to this in your Irish Examiner piece, which, like, if nobody's, I can't imagine people are listening to this and haven't read it, but just in case you haven't, read the piece. It's very good. You do talk about the fact that if construction was seen as less of a craft and more of an engineering discipline, which is what it's seen in the continent, particularly in Germany and other places, you would see a revolution in home building technology here. You'd see a revolution in green building technology here. You'd see the universities being tasked with the production of not just universities, of course, but also the technological universities and IoTs and colleges and etc. The Solace, there's no real distinction between further and higher education in my mind in this world, but you'd start seeing that happening, and that would be a really interesting thing to happen as well. The previous mad building episode, really the state experience, was between 2001 and 2007. And a lot of that building, actually, particularly the motorways and other massive capital projects, it actually took place on the ground, like boots on the ground, with foreign workers. So yeah. We had Turkish firms building motorways and stuff.
I remember the Gamma controversy being...
Exactly, right? And so the idea of actually having an in-house, on the ground, high-spec, high-production, high-maintenance kind of group is interesting. Downsides of the argument, very obvious. The first is the private sector doesn't really do delivery like this at speed or at scale. So that's a big downside. Would need to be avoided. Second big downside, yes, you are removing the developer's profits. So you immediately keep 20 or 30% in terms of the equation that I mapped at before. You do have an issue. And your issue is if the actual cost of construction goes up because the wages are very high, well then obviously you've wiped out any potential value that you've produced. So it's an interesting proposal that I'd love to sort of bat around with you a little bit.
Yeah, it's I appreciate you, taking the time to set that out there around what are the potential for it. And I think that it's really something for me when I was looking at the figures and you talk about, the potential for crowding out or that when I was looking through the number of workers, for example, who are, give me one second, the kid is in. In terms of the number of workers, and we're laughing here because I had an interlude for my kid there who I just had to tell to be quiet there, please, a bit while I'm doing this. In terms of the workers, that you have about 150,000 construction workers and in around 40,000, I was surprised that only 40,000 are actually building homes. And if you set up a public enterprise that, as you talked about, maybe you take over a company, maybe you start building it from scratch. I think maybe that might be an approach as well, and do it quite quickly, that you would be scaling up to, like, DSB, for example, has 10,000 workers. If you had 10,000 workers in a public enterprise company, it's still a quarter of the workforce in terms of building homes in the country. So it wouldn't be crowding out. And I think that for me, the key was looking at it was that issue of we lost so many workers, skilled workers, to emigration during the period of 2008, 2009, 2013, in around 70,000. Like, it's a whole generation of construction workers. And we're highly likely that could happen again with another office bubble, another, the build-to-rent investor fund bubble, and the major shift that's happened within the construction employment sector is it has all shifted to the subcontracting, these forms of bogus self-employment. So you have no actual career path, and young people aren't engaging in it. And it seems to me, as I made the point that health is as, housing is as fundamental to our lives as health and education, yet we don't guarantee the delivery of that. And I think that the argument that came back against me, and I did an interview on News Talk with Pat Kenny, where he at some level ridiculed it by saying that public enterprise can't run anything. So what, look at the Children's Hospital, look at the HSE, look at, public enterprise isn't good. Maybe you do a small pilot and see how it goes. How would you counter that, idea that, well, public enterprise doesn't work? It's actually a failed way of doing things.
Yeah, well, so the version of the Children's Hospital is not built by the state, right? That there's a big difference between the state as capital allocator and the state as actual service provider, right? So even, we talk about the hospitals, right? The hospital system is the state providing the capital and another entity, the HSE, actually doing the job. So that actually goes back to a theory in the late 1970s, early 1980s called New Public Management, which is the idea that the state shouldn't be doing this stuff.
Yeah.
Very
strongly linked with Thatcherism.
Indeed. And this idea that, well, the private sector does efficiency and that's great. Yeah. There's been a fairly large literature now that's developed, and particularly around public-private partnerships, but in other spaces too. And in fact, two of my colleagues here in UL, Professor Owen Reeves and Dr. Donald Palchik, they literally wrote the book on privatization and the experience of privatization in Ireland. Yeah. And their conclusion, is you do get some efficiencies out of the private sector, by making the public sector the private sector, so you lose a lot as well. Right. So, I mean, my argument for nationalizing, a big builder is speed. If you start from scratch, like the LDA is an idea, the Land Development Agency is an idea that, it's like 10 years old, right? And like, they're not really up and running yet. They're not really delivering units. So you'd want to sort of pay a little bit of a price to get up and running quickly. The analog the argument I would make is when the state actually has a clear mission, build more homes, it is extraordinarily efficient. Our state uniquely across many other countries does the boring stuff incredibly well. And this is an argument that Ed Brophy makes, the former advisor to Patrick Donoghue. He makes this argument and he's absolutely right. When it comes to paying pensions and fixing potholes and the basic stuff, the state does it extremely well, you know. And we saw this when we needed to pay nearly 1 million people when the generation of the PUP came out. So that they literally figured out how to do that in 4 days, 4 days straight. They figured out how to get people paid. That's grand. So the state as ATM is an extremely powerful and very, very, very effective system. When the state goes and tries to manage the interaction between itself and private providers, that's where things go wrong. And you see that with the schools, which are they're not part of the state. Most of our school system is not actually part of the state. It's owned by a different company. That company is called the Catholic Church, but it's a company. You know, it's another organization. And similarly, the hospital system is also managed by different subunits of the same company. And it's like, you know, when you look at the state's decision to provide vaccines at scale, at speed, at scope, it's able to do that. It can do these things. When the Troika came into town, you know, like I was in and around government buildings for a lot of that period, and the ability of the
system. So was I, but I was holding the placard outside.
But the ability of the system to react, my point is very strong.
Yeah, yeah. So, I think as well, though, surely, like when you look at our primary schools, and I know, you know, many of them are church run, but they're public sector employees. You know, we look at our universities, we look at, you know, the DART system, our rail system, our hospitals. It's all public sector workers who are delivering incredibly effective, efficient services. So I don't buy it, but I think that's a really interesting idea, the interface, that it's where that you see that interaction between the public and private, because I also did a lot of my PhD was actually on public-private partnerships, and I wrote a book about it as well, and linked in with your colleagues. That was what I found, that essentially the private sector, and it was all that new public management stuff, broadly called neoliberalism, the idea the state had failed, went back to the idea as well, social housing as an entity, as a concept, had failed as well. It was all about shifting to the private sector. But essentially, the private sector was coming in and saying, well, we know this now, you pay us, but you pay us a premium. And essentially, it was the state was handing over its skills and capacity. And from that period of 2000 really onwards, that started the long undermining of local authorities in their capacity to build, where we then reach this point now where we don't have the capacity. And I think that if the state does it itself, as you say, it does a really good job. But when it tries to manage it with the private sector, I think that's where the problem really arises, as you're saying.
Yeah, I think, you know, there is a big move now. I mean, it's most associated with the economist Mariana Mazzucato. And it is interesting, most of the ideas that really push this forward are the mission-orientated innovation ideas of Mazzucato and Perez and these people. But it's a new form of public-private partnership where the public is really in control, right? Where the government says, look, this is what we're doing. You guys get in behind it or don't, but we're going in this direction. I think it is the command part of the command and control economy that they're talking about bringing back in. But like in an Irish context, like what you want to do is you need to build more homes, not houses, homes. And you obviously need to avoid ghettoization and et cetera. But if I look out the window of my office, like, you know, it is really interesting to me that I do not see sixth, eighth story buildings around me, right? I should. there's no reason for like I'm in a giant university campus. There's no particular reason why we shouldn't have student accommodation all around us.
Yeah.
Soundproofed, hopefully, because they do make a noise. But like the we don't have student accommodation. I have students dealing with this issue right now, like just before I came on this call, of students who don't have accommodation, right?
Yeah.
University can't build it.
This is the point. They could, if they were facilitated by the government and helped to borrow, because they're actually...
No, they can't. I mean, like I've already had this discussion. No, there's no scope to do that kind of stuff. The cost of construction, like I've had the exact conversation. Cost of construction relative to the revenue that you'll bring in mean that the project is not bankable.
It's not bankable.
You literally can't borrow the money. So yeah. It's not a case of like, ooh, maybe, you know, this, right, it's not right wing or left wing. It's just finance. It's literally just, and this is not bankable in conditions where you're probably going to borrow the money of the European Investment Bank.
Yeah.
Like that's, when somebody who's borrowing at like 1% or 2% max says to you, I can't make this work, what that's telling you is there's a fundamental imbalance between construction costs and affordability. Now, there is another option, by the way. There is another option.
Which of course points to, of course, the need for a construction company, a public construction company that could.
The point about the construction company is you turn around and you say, I will vastly increase the size of the public housing stock, not social, but public housing.
Yeah.
Because I do think social housing in this country is a particular emotional resonance. It connotes a particular class structure. I just hands up in the air, like I grew up in social housing, so you know I'm not from a leafy suburb, to put it mildly. So when I understand that it has a certain emotional resonance. I mean public housing, which is housing built for the public that is currently continually owned by the public. Another part of the discussion that's it's often elided in these discussions, but I'm 100% up for increasing the stock of public housing, and at pretty much any cost to the taxpayer. And the reason is you're going to hold this stuff for 100 years, 150 years, right? Buildings like in Paris. Or buildings, you go to Madrid, you go to Seville, you go to these places, you see the buildings, they're old buildings. So you go to New York, they're centuries old. There's been millions of people have gone through those buildings. The stock of social housing in this country flexes because the state purchases the stuff, the private sector builds it, it's handed to somebody as a deeply discounted capital asset. And that person then has the opportunity to buy that thing and sell it.
Yeah,
that is it. To my mind, the discussion in this country is deeply mistaken, because I am up for anything that builds up the stock of housing, but that means you have to stop people from acquiring this discounted asset onto their personal balance sheet. You have to keep it on the balance sheet of the state, and that is a very, very, very difficult discussion to have.
It is a really, really difficult one, and it raises straight away a number of questions, which is, for example, we're just hearing now today the central bank has come out. I don't know if you saw, it's literally just breaking that they have approved the shared equity scheme of the government, which is interesting. And they're saying they're not changing the mortgage lending rules, but that they're very worried about the potential instability of investor funds, that the role that they have grown in the market. And the quote from the central bank governor, which is reported by Owen Burke Kennedy in the Irish Times, there is what he said was that the arrival of overseas investment represents a beneficial diversification. The central bank said there was a cohort of property funds that had high levels of leverage and to a lesser extent liquidity mismatches. And absent of policy interventions, these vulnerabilities have the potential to grow or become widespread in the future, and the property fund sector could respond to future adverse shocks through the sales of property assets over a short period of time. What's your view on the investor funds and the buy-to-let? I've been getting a lot of...
Let's
say a polite disagreement, or not so polite disagreement, for opposing that's particular, I think, form, and Central Bank is naming it, I describe it as a predatory form of speculative investment rather than a long-term form of sustainable homes. I don't see how building build-to-rent at 2,000 euro a month for a one-bedroom apartment is a sustainable form of housing, and I don't see at what point it will lead to a reduction in rents. What's your view on it?
Yeah, so I mean, if you just go back one step, right? Go back to the discussion about from the central bank. What they're saying is, if things go wrong for these fellas, they're really talking about inflation there. They're saying, oh, the rate of inflation will go up. Central banks will be forced to raise interest rates. If interest rates go up, then the cost of capital to these fellas goes up.
Yeah,
their margins go down. Oh my God, we need to get rid of that property in Dublin, sell off all that stuff. And then all of a sudden, the average price of those assets falls. Now, what's interesting about that as an argument is that the central bank is effectively saying, oh no, there could be house price decreases in Dublin. Now, I have long maintained that the actual conduct of all policy in Ireland exists to keep house prices going up.
Yeah.
And 2%, 3%, 4% a year, every year, so well above inflation, right? So that the assets of this barely taxed asset, this barely taxed thing that people in Ireland understand as a pension, which is in other parts of the world, is insane, right? The only reason it is because as a financial asset, it's one of the most lightly taxed assets that we have. And if I were Minister for Finance tomorrow, the first thing I would do is levy a serious wealth tax on this kind of stuff. I do believe it should be the case that the financial asset element that a house represents or home represents needs to be decreased, which would decrease its attractiveness to these funds. If the funds get in financial trouble and they sell those properties, to whom will they sell them? They'll sell them to the state, most likely, or other investors. I believe that the discussion that we keep seeing about build to rent or the BTR kind of system, which is essentially the looking at the top 10% of the market the whole time and assuming that something designed for the top 10% of the market is going to, or top 10% of the population really, is going to satisfy the bottom 90% is insane. It doesn't make any sense. You don't see BTR stuff going up around Limerick or Galway or Waterford, right? It's all just, it's a Dublin play financially. So like, I don't see it as a, I think we're focusing overly on it. I think the debate around BTRs has gone from the, is this a good idea or a bad idea, to, I don't know, it's taken on a certain ideological and deeply, I would say divisive kind of tone.
Just to be clear here,
I believe it's also furthering the wrong policy objective. If the policy objective is keep property prices increasing, then they're great. If the objective is you want more affordable housing for people, for middle and lower middle class households, and particularly single people, these much smaller households that we know we're having, then what you have to do, you have to solve the affordability equation. You just have to. Now, I did say there is a second way of doing this. So you've moved on your proposal is all in the cost space, right?
Yeah.
The second way of doing this is just to raise people's wages.
Yeah. Right?
And like it's much simpler as an idea. Just raise everyone's wages. And what is inflation doing but causing that kind of discussion? You're starting to see a real serious labor shortage in this country. Despite the fact that we've got nearly double digit in unemployment rates. You see shortages everywhere. It's a really, really interesting thing. You're going to see large scale wage inflation in 2022. And I think it's no bad thing. It's no bad thing because it does solve the affordability
except,
element on your side.
Except that, and I am absolutely in favor, clearly, of wage increases. But I don't think it does, because you still have a problem. It's just like the central bank extending the mortgage rules or the shared equity scheme. In the absence of an increase in supply, increased wages mean more money chasing the limited stock. And so it will add further to rental inflation and house price inflation.
I don't know if there's a t-shirt that I can buy that says we need to increase supply, right? But I'm a fully paid up member of the just build more bleeding houses, lads, will you? Yeah. Camp. From that perspective, building anything, BTR or a shack or something between two train tracks, is a good thing because it clears out at least one.
But this is the point,
the next person. Right.
This is the point.
The problem is you're not building enough of them. And I believe this is Ronan Lyon's argument in the currency and a few other people's, is that, look, the problem is you're never building enough. So you're never building enough of an increase in the stock to force this price dynamic down. You need to be building 10, 15, 20,000 houses.
Exactly.
We're building five. So it's not going to happen. You know?
Exactly. And I think that kind of goes back to kind of one of my central tenets, is that you can't explain or respond to housing in the same way as a normal functioning market. It doesn't operate like that because the providers are looking at it. And for example, there is, we know and have known for decades that there has been a controlling essence of land, holding of land. There is land hoarding goes on. The developers, the investors only provide enough so that it will not jeopardize their, the prices, the rents. And we look at, for example, the vacancy in Capital Dock. And that when you look at it, that actually, I think a build to rent supply, also what happens is, what's happening is these investment funds are competing for land prices, for land. So they're actually pushing up land prices, which pushes up overall rents and costs and prices. And so therefore, yes, they're providing a supply, but this form of supply is actually worsening the cost problem. So I think that it's not necessarily the case that all supply is good supply. And it particularly, when, as you said, it's for the top 10%. And I think it adds to the costs within the housing system.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you think about our system, the system is fundamentally based around the idea that somebody will acquire a bit of land on the edge of a village or something, and then they'll buy it through some let's just be charitable and call it a non-linear process. And then they'll build. I think when you need to think about large scale, large scope and fast paced development, you actually have to think in terms of, NASA style missions. We will put a man on the moon and return him safely by the year 1970. We will end homelessness by 2030. We need to have a mission like that coming from government. And then what actually happens is the system kind of figures out the answer to that question, and which is why the whole idea of a state-owned and state-developer, really not just a developer, which is what the LDA is, but actually a state builder, would be very, very, very interesting to explore. I'd be interested to hear from people who are experts in the corporate finance of this, because this is not, you can't just magic the money up. Like, ultimately, this thing does have to earn some kind of commercial return. It will have to have even if it's 1%, it can't just lose money every year. It can't fall into a black hole of corporate finance just because of EU accounting rules, right?
Yeah.
So, there are certain elements that this, I was being slightly facetious by saying, oh yeah, look, let it lose money forever. It's just a state. That the reality is, that's going to be much more tricky to do. But if you just think about it, an NHS style thing, imagine this thing buys 10 million bricks. Right?
Yeah.
Like, there you go. There's no more brick shortage, or it buys all the steel, that kind of stuff. By buying in bulk, you get big discounts, you get big shipping changes. All of a sudden, things change. But the two downsides, as I said, one is it cannot sell the stuff that it builds back to the private sector, which is the households.
Yeah. Right?
It just can't do it. Has to increase the stock in order to keep a ceiling floor. Other big thing, which is really interesting, is will it be able to do this at speed? Because you've got people sleeping in their cars today and it needs to be fixed quickly.
Yeah. Well, listen, Stephen Kinsler, thanks so much for taking the time to come on Reboot Republic. Wonderful to chat to you. Great to hear the ideas, and hopefully we can continue the conversation, and hopefully actually these ideas will be taken up and progressed.
Let's see. Thanks very much for having me.
Thanks, Stephen. And listen, listeners, thank you so much for taking the time to have a listen, to for supporting us, to our patrons. You can listen back to other podcasts we've had recently covering the housing issue, covering homelessness. We're doing a series where we're people who are affected by the crisis are telling their story, talking about it. You can check that out and back issues. We talked to Kira, we talked to David, to Sharon. You can have a listen to those, and we also analyze ongoing analysis of the causes of the crisis, of solutions, and of course wider issues around inequality and how we can create a better country where people's standard of living is improved and where everyone has a real quality of life. So listen, thank you everyone for listening. Thank you again to Stephen Kinsler, and we'll talk to you all soon.